Hello, this is Vince Quattrini, and I want to welcome you to the Legal Checkup, sponsored by our law firm of Quattrini Rafferty, with offices in Greensburg, Pittsburgh, and Latrobe. I'm your host, and today with me I have Dr. Louis Catalano, a well-recognized and eminent neurologist in the Westmoreland County area with a national reputation. Good afternoon, doctor.
Nice Hello.
Nice to see you, and thanks for being here with me. Today, we have the unique opportunity to talk with Dr. Catalano about problems of aging. Dr. Catalano is actually celebrating his 50th year of practicing medicine. Congratulations, doctor.
Thank you.
And what I thought the people of Western Pennsylvania would appreciate hearing from you is what you're seeing on a daily basis in your practice of neurology. I thought maybe we'd do like the top three or top five problems that you see with elderly patients on a regular basis.
Well, I'm still very actively practicing and engaged in both the hospital and in my office. In the office, we see lots of different kinds of neurological problems, which is actually often different than what I see in the hospital. So there's two kinds of populations of elderly people that we can see.
Let's talk about that a moment. What are the differences that you see? What is your elderly hospital patient primary diagnoses, right, versus your office diagnoses?
Okay, well, let's do it this way. In the office, we'll see patients that are brought in for memory trouble, trouble walking or falling, or more obviously have, say, Parkinson's disease, or have chronic pain issues. We can see them for one of the most common ones, what we call neuropathy, where they'll have painful, burning nerve endings in their hands and feet, this sort of thing. These are more elective, if you will, things that we'll see in the office. Now, in the hospital, because of the way medicine is practiced anymore, we tend to see more hyperacute type symptoms.
What
and
does
problems.
That mean?
Well, we're there. Something that just developed the other day. It's a dramatic change in their clinical condition, and they're not able to function as an outpatient for various reasons. They need urgent diagnostic workup. They need urgent care.
What are some of those examples?
Well, one of the most common ones would be a typical thing is what we call a change in mental status.
Okay.
Where the patient just suddenly becomes confused, agitated, not able to recognize his family, and so forth. Another older name perhaps for this is called a delirium, where they don't know where they are. Confabulate, they're talking nonsense not comprehensible speech and so forth.
I bet that's very distressing to the family to have something occur like that.
Yeah, very distressing. And unfortunately, and I mean this sincerely, unfortunately, many elderly people don't have family anymore around. The kids are, one's in Florida, the other's in Colorado. So we often have very limited history of what's happened. We don't know. Sometimes a spouse can't even tell us what happened to the patient for various reasons. or they may be living alone. So they're found by a neighbor laying down on the floor or unconscious or have been ill for a few days or a week or two before they're actually brought to the hospital. And these patients can be very, very ill. The more of a technical name that we give this is called a toxic metabolic encephalopathy. So they have lots of things going wrong inside their brain, a biochemical derangement in their brain. So this can be due to a kidney failure. It can be due to liver failure. It can be due to trouble oxygenation with their lungs. They may have a pneumonia. Or they can be septic.
What does that mean?
Septic means they can have an infection in their bloodstream. This is commonly seen in the elderly due to urinary tract infections. They can be critically ill. A person that was perfectly normal just a few days ago may be moribund in a matter of a few hours and need very intensive medical attention because they've been sick for a couple of days at home, didn't come into the hospital timely, so they're very sick. So that's an acute change in mental status. Now, other causes are, for example, a stroke can cause an acute change in mental status. Usually that looks a little bit different. The patients will have weakness or numbness in their arms or legs. They may have difficulty with walking. They may complain of headache or double vision. This looks actually usually different than the average toxic metabolic delirium mental status change.
We're talking today with Louis Catalano, a neurologist in the Westmoreland County area, and our subject is the elderly and the problems that Dr. Catalano sees on a regular basis with his patients, both in his office and in the hospital. So we were going to focus on some of the top three problems that you see. You've been explaining that to us. Alzheimer dementia patients, I imagine that the incidence of that is growing in Western Pennsylvania.
Well, it's growing in the United States. It's an epidemic. The statistics are kind of meaningless, but in a way, if we all live long enough, we probably all are at great risk for developing memory loss. And it can be mild, moderate, or severe like everything else in medicine. There are certain risk factors for developing Alzheimer's disease.
What are some of those?
Heredity plays some role. It's not a one-for-one, but it's a risk factor. That if you have a family history on one side or the other of dementia, you may be at some risk for having this yourself at later in life.
Doc, let me stop there. So I'm worried about that, let's say. Are there ways that me as a child of a parent can help them? Are there warning signs? Are there medications, lifestyle changes that can slow this down? What are the recommendations that you make to your patients?
So you're talking about somebody who, say your father or mother that has memory trouble, what you could do about it?
Yes.
Not for yourself, but for a relative, right? Okay.
Yes.
The most important thing is understand what's going on.
Okay.
And I guess the best way to put it is you need to have a diagnosis. Just guessing that it's Alzheimer's disease in this day and age maybe isn't really quite good enough. But the hallmark of Alzheimer's disease is a very gradual, progressive loss of cognitive function or memory over a period of a couple years. So the average person that I see in my office has had this story going on for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. So it's not like it began yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the hospital, it's interesting, just flipping back quickly to that, is that many patients who have early Alzheimer's disease don't do very well in the hospital.
No.
So they can come into the hospital with a sore foot, a broken bone, you know, gout or something unrelated. And in the hospital, they get really, really confused and disoriented and deteriorate memory-wise.
Is that maybe because there's a change in routine?
Yes.
And they don't have as much control over their surroundings?
And in their environment. So any change in the environment. So you know, this is often, even among my colleagues, you know, this is kind of viewed as, well, it's all hospital psychosis, delirium. Something else caused it, so forth. But many patients who have early Alzheimer's disease actually can manifest inside the hospital.
We're going to take a break at this point. You're listening to The Legal Checkup, sponsored by the law firm of Quattrini Rafferty. Today we have the enjoyable experience of talking to Louis Catalano, a renowned neurologist in the Westmoreland County area. And I wanted to remind you that you could always call our law firm at 888-534-6016. As you know, we deal with disability issues all day, every day. We'll be back in a few moments. We're back on The Legal Checkup. This is your host, Vince Quattrini, talking today with Dr. Louis Catalano. Doctor, we're on the subject of Alzheimer's. You were telling us about presentation in the hospital setting, and you wanted to tell us how people typically present in your office setting.
Well, the most common story I hear in the office is somebody in the family brings in a patient that is telling me that they have had a very gradual decline in their memory over a period of a few years, minimum of 2 to 3, and sometimes 4 to 5 before they're actually brought in, but average is 3 years.
And so what do you do now with that kind of presentation? I imagine you have a series of questions that you use to do your differential diagnosing?
Absolutely. The most common thing as a clinician is we look at, you know, right from the very beginning, what are some of the risk factors?
Okay.
So we want to ask, you know, anybody else in the family have this problem? How old is the patient? Because obviously one of the biggest risk factors is old age or becoming elderly, I'll put it that way. Now, that's not to say that you can be 90 and you can have a normal memory.
Mm-hmm.
So we think that losing your memory is not normal. Losing your memory is abnormal. And the big question is there a diagnosis causing it? And is there something we can do about it, or what else needs to be done for it? So we talked about age being a risk factor. We talked about the natural history of presentation. Another very interesting thing, and I think it's useful for people to know, is that the single biggest protection of developing Alzheimer's disease is education.
Oh.
That the more educated you are, the lower your risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. So individuals that have not gone to finished high school are even at greater risk for developing dementia. Patients that have finished high school are 2 years better off. If you finish college, you have another 2 years. If you finish graduate school, you have another 2 years. So every couple years of education pays off in delaying dementia. It's been studied all over the world. This is a universal fact, and this has been studied in many countries. So it's not just piecemeal.
So let me interrupt a moment. I only finished high school, but I'm 42 years old, let's say. What could I do then to get some of this built-in education advantage? Do I take courses at the community college? Do I go online and try to learn how to speak French? Are there ways that I can fight that?
Well, the most recent fad is brain games, okay, which I really don't know a lot about, because I think my job probably is enough intellectual stimulation. But the government, as a matter of fact, made the companies that promoted this activity quit advertising it. So they pushed back on it for the past year or so. They were demanding some scientific proof.
Okay.
So the paper was just recently published saying, well, it might help. So we're probably going to go back to that issue again. But
so if I'm doing brain games all day, yeah, that may just be fun
help
to do, but no help.
Yeah, I think it's limited. But I do think that sustained educational experience is very valuable and neuroprotective. And I think in the long run, we're going to find that continuing to work and be engaged in meaningful activity is probably neuroprotective. I mean, if you just retire when you're 62 and don't do anything except watch TV for the rest of your life, you probably aren't gaining all the advantages that you could have in terms of intellectual stimulation.
So here's one. Crossword puzzles. Everybody talks about that being neuroprotective. Is there any science behind that? Or
I don't know of any actual science. Actually, I was kind of struck by the fact, you know, I read an article not too long ago. It said men do crossword puzzles more often than women. I was actually surprised at that. For some reason, I thought, you know.
Do you think it has anything to do with trying to phase out the person that's talking to you part of the day?
Well, it might be. But I think most people that do crossword puzzles probably aren't viewing it as a brain game per se, you know, to keep from getting Alzheimer's disease.
So we're having a really enjoyable discussion today with Dr. Louis Catalano, a neurologist in the Westmoreland County area who sees elderly patients on a regular basis. This is Vince Quattrini, your host of The Legal Checkup, the program sponsored by the law firm of Quattrini Rafferty. And doctor, let's go on to some other common diagnoses in the elderly. You were telling me about epilepsy. What's the correlation there?
Well, I'm glad we have a chance to mention this. It's one of my particular devotions. I've been involved with the Epilepsy Foundation for many years. I've been on their board of directors and had a charity fundraiser for over 20 years here.
Let me interrupt you and have you tell this audience, how much money did you raise over those years through those dinners that I came to religiously every year?
$1 million.
Yeah, congratulations.
Yeah.
So anyway.
And, but it was a labor of love, and
yes,
we actually gave it up this year after 20 years. We were running out of
new
energy,
ideas.
I guess yeah, I'll put it that too. Way. Yes. But
so,
anyway.
Epilepsy.
Yeah, epilepsy. Well, nationally in the United States, 3% of the population has epilepsy. Hmm. And if you live long enough, your risk of having a seizure is very substantial. The incidence of epilepsy goes up as we age. We used to think, even 30, 40, 50 years ago, we used to think of epilepsy as a childhood disease. But we now know that it is not just a childhood disease, that the real risk of developing epilepsy is aging. And there are a number of reasons for that. Part of it is due to trauma. Part of it is due to vascular disease of the brain. And probably some reasons that we don't quite understand. But by the time we're in our 80s, the risk of having a seizure is better than 5% of the population. By the time you're 90, over 10% of the population has epilepsy. And in the nursing homes, for example, it's just incredible the incidence of patients taking anti-epileptic drugs because of seizures. So we think that the risk factors probably involve microvascular disease of the brain. But, of course, there are other things. For example, stroke contributes, where we definitely know the patient's had a stroke. There are two kinds of stroke, a hemorrhage and a thrombotic stroke or an artery blockage. A brain hemorrhage actually greatly predisposes for epilepsy. And the reason is the blood in the brain is a very strong irritant to the brain tissue. Hmm. So the subsequent development of epilepsy after a brain hemorrhage is very high.
So are there any neuroprotective resources against epilepsy in aging, or any other suggestions you can make to try to lower your incidence rate?
Well, the studies have consistently showed over the years that if you have a head injury, putting you on an anti-epileptic drug is really of no value in terms of prevention.
Mm-hmm.
In severe head injury, my neurosurgical colleagues generally will treat the patient for a while with seizure medicines, but that's usually effective if they've had a seizure from the head injury. But as a prevention, it probably doesn't do very much. Many neurosurgeons are now not using seizure medicines prophylactically or preventatively anymore. But the best thing I can say about prevention of having seizures is try to avoid having a head injury, which definitely is a great risk factor. Falls and trauma, if you will. We can't slow down aging yet, but maybe we'll have a pill for that someday. And prevention of neurological complications due to medical illness, such as hypertension, high cholesterol, diabetes, these are all very large risk factors for mini strokes or strokes to the brain or other injury to the brain itself, even small blood vessels. And so control of all risk factors is very important.
And thank you, Doctor. We're going to end there today. You're listening to Dr. Louis Catalano, a neurologist in the Westmoreland County area, on the program The Legal Checkup with your host, Vince Quattrini. We're going to continue this conversation with Dr. Catalano at a later date. Doctor, thank you very much. This has been a personal pleasure for me.
Thank you, Vince. Thank you so much.